We're about to listen to a conversation I hosted with Eddie Conway last week at Red Emma's bookstore. Eddie Conway is the Black Panther who was incarcerated for 44 years, arrested during the time of COINTELPRO, charged with murdering a policeman that many now realize he did not do. He's the author of two books, The Greatest Threat, The Black Panther Party on COINTELPRO, and Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, which he wrote with Dominique Stevenson while he was in prison, obviously. Eddie was released earlier this year, and I was honored to host this conversation with him. Eddie discusses his time in prison, his work with young men inside and outside of prison, and Friend of a Friend, a mentoring project he started with the American Friends Service Committee that works to reduce institutional violence and violence among young people by providing tools that build healthy relationships, create support structures, and develop this incredible effective communication skill program inside the prisons, which is now taking outside to the streets and the community. Later on the show, we'll meet Green Bay, who is one of the young men Eddie mentored and was part of Friend of a Friend. But first, here's my conversation with Eddie Conway.
Okay, look, I just want to thank everybody that has supported me and supported other political prisoners throughout the last four decades that dozens of us have been locked up from the termited times of the 70s. And it's important to understand that your cards, your letters, your fundraisers, even your well wishes have always been appreciated, and it's been helpful, and I'm encouraging you to continue that kind of activity with the other political prisoners that's still in the prison system today.
This is a huge, momentous time because political prisoners walking out after all these years doesn't happen very often. It happens with a few people. It happened with Geronimo, a few others, Daruba, and we have Eddie Conway here home with us now. And I'll take you back all those years ago when there was a revolutionary movement in the city, still is one now, and a police officer was murdered, and Eddie Conway was arrested, taken away from his job at the post office. And as we tell you a quick story before we start, we covered his life in prison a lot over the last 21 years on the radio. And one of those shows where one of his friends and attorneys, Marty Walker, was on there, so was his prosecutor, one of his prosecutors. And on that show, and I think it was 1995, the prosecutor said, "If I had known now what I knew then, I wouldn't have prosecuted Eddie Conway. He should be a free man." He said that on our show in 1995. So now Eddie Conway is a free man. So let's begin this way, Eddie. I mean, you went into prison, out of the army, in the Panthers, in prison. You went in as a revolutionary. You came out a revolutionary. That didn't stop. But talk about that process, because things change. I mean, you went in prison in 1970, right? So prison systems changed. The way of life in those prisons changed. The pressure on you changed over the years. So talk a bit about that.
Okay, probably when I went it was 1971 when I went into the Maryland Penitentiary. I spent a year over in Baltimore City Jail. When I got in the Maryland Penitentiary, it was like going back into the 30s or the 40s. I really couldn't believe it. Prisoners were being abused. They were being treated like animals. There was many rebellions throughout the whole entire penitentiary. Incidents would jump off. Just for instance, the first day that I went into the prison system, I had been in the hole for like 15 days over in city jail. I hadn't eaten. They was basically feeding us bread and water three times a day. They had us locked in, and you could not come out. You couldn't take a shower. You couldn't do anything. So when I went into the prison system, I had 21 days of that under my belt. So the first thing that happened is when I got a chance to go to eat, I sat down, and it was this huge plate of food, and I have to admit it was better then than it is now. And I started eating because I was extremely hungry. I had lost weight and everything. And all of a sudden, God come by, he bang on the table, and everybody at the table gets up and they walk away. Well, I don't know the rules at this point. I just got there, and I'm hungry. So I'm eating. So I continue to eat. And kind of like everybody said, well, no, you got to go. I'm saying, why? I need to eat. You know, it's the first opportunity I get to eat. So the guards actually start congregating around the edge of the table as if I was doing something, like I was breaking some kind of law or something. And this attracted the attention of a lot of prisoners. And they started gathering around and basically saying, let that brother eat, leave him alone, so on. So I recognized that there was an incident brewing right there the first day. So I said, well, okay, I'm done, because I didn't want to, like, create, you know, conflict that very first day in the penitentiary. So I got up, I threw half of my food away, even though I wasn't finished, and I walked out. But it was that kind of volatile kind of situation that I walked into, and every time I turned around, it was either a guard attacking the prisoner or a prisoner attacking the prisoner, or some sort of incident was going on every week. And so the first thing that hit me was, well, okay, we need to kind of like organize the prisoners to do something to change the conditions, because the basic thing was, and this was during the years of George Jackson, this was during like the time of Attica, the basic thing was we were being treated like animals. Well, I had been like in the army for like 3 years. I had been in Europe. I had been like across the country. And, you know, there was no way I could stand for being treated like an animal. So, you know, right off the bat, it was like, no, we have to change these conditions, because we're not animals. And even though they had convinced some of the prisoners in there that we were animals, and they basically were snatching people, and this was something that was a normal procedure, they were snatching people up that gave them any kind of back talk, and they would beat them down right there. And they would drag them down the aisle, and they would drag them past us, and they would drag them out the door. And if anybody in the audience said anything, they would come back and get you. You know, so this was the kind of conditions that we went into. So I started organizing. There was hundreds of brothers in there that wanted to organize, that wanted to change those conditions. They didn't have the leadership at the time, and they didn't have, like, the skills at the time. And even though I didn't have it, I understood that collectively we could get together and we could decide to do things to change the conditions. And that's what we did. We formed a collective, and we organized around the conditions that affected all the other prisoners, so we won their support. And in the process, we challenged the idea of the demographics of the guard system. 98-99% white guards, 2% black guards. That was the source of a lot of the conflict. That was the source of a lot of the beatings. We managed to force change in that area. We managed to force change in the area of the working conditions. At the time, it's not much better now, incidentally, but at the time we were making 27 cents a day. Well, I don't even know what the math is on that in terms of an hour, but it was not enough to buy soap, toothpaste, and or cigarettes or deodorant, which all of those things were things that we had to buy. You could not afford to just take care of yourself with the pay. So we organized a United Prisoner Labor Union, and we worked with the 1199E. And that's the same labor union that Dr. Martin Luther King was working with when he was assassinated in Tennessee. They adopted us as a prisoner labor union, and they started working with us. And pretty much what happened is that the reaction from the administration toward that kind of organizing was more hostile than the kind of combat interaction that was going on. Initially, the guys were fighting all the time. Once we got the guys to stop fighting and start talking about a living wage, start talking about minimum wage, start talking about like health benefits and stuff like that, well, they went crazy. And initially, I was thinking about this on the way down here, and I was thinking back, and I realized that the street organizations that exist today in a lot of the communities have their genesis in the organizing that we were doing in the prison, because the prison administration decided to organize and allow street organizations, or if you call them gangs, you can call them gangs, they decided to allow them to develop and operate to block what we were doing because they wanted chaos and disruption. So they allowed those young groups to grow, and those young groups grew then, and I didn't pay any attention to it, but they continued to grow and continued to grow until you see what you see now. But this is definitely, and it's funny, it's a film called Made in America, and I hadn't really given it any thought, but this is made in America. They made this right in the prison system, and they made it against the activities that we were doing in trying to humanize the rest of the population and get a living wage, and so that we could take care of ourselves and be treated like people. And the reaction to that was, like, let's create a destructive apparatus that will keep the population in chaos. Now, today, while prisoners are not treated as animals, well, with the exception probably, and I'll talk about that later on, in some of the outlying prisons, they're not treated as animals, but the prison population has been largely dehumanized by the way in which we are now viewed. Well, we're not we anymore. Okay. The way in which prisoners are viewed, it's like they took away our clothes, they took away the identity, they took away the voice, they took away the rebellion that happens now is fragmented and it's manipulated to keep us at each other in terms of speaking of the prison itself, right? They kind of reward that kind of behavior. They reward the conflicts. They encourage the conflicts. They tend to transfer the people that are trying to do progressive organizing. They tend to transfer people all over the state that's doing stuff that would bring about positive development in the prison system. That's deliberate. And I hate to say this because I'm probably, along with some other guys, partly responsible for the creature comforts, like the telephones, we forced them to bring them in, the televisions, we forced them to bring them in, the Game Boy things and all of that kind of stuff is being used now to kind of like pacify and distract the population and stop the prison population from thinking like we were thinking 40 years ago. We're humans and we want to be free. And if we can't be free, we want to at least change the conditions so that it will be conducive for us to be constantly in touch with our families, for us to be constantly part of the larger community. That's not happening anymore. Now the drive is toward isolating everybody from the community. The drive is toward putting everybody in uniforms and creating an almost subhuman population, because when you and it's like little subtle things, and one of the things is that they stopped, say, oils and certain kind of shaving cream scents and that kind of stuff, because when you have guards come through, they got on the aftershave, they got on the oil. I mean, they come through, they, you know, they smell like humans, whatever, right? You have a prisoner, the prisoner's not allowed to have any of those things. And you know, so you're in a uniform, you know, and for the most part, sometimes you're not well kept because you don't have enough money to kind of like do that grooming. And then you can tell you don't smell like the person in authority. I mean, and that's small and it's subtle, but it's the kind of psychological kind of warfare that's going on. It gets worse, but I think we'll deal with that a little bit later on. I haven't got too carried away.
This is your show. I'm just up here. I mean, I think that it's important to kind of think about how much that system changed inside, both in terms of population, the consciousness of the prisoners who were in jail with you over that 40 years, and the change in terms of the youth. I remember my period of time working inside of Hagerstown with young people inside an adult population in the 70s is very different than what is happening now. And the young population is different. So that arc is a huge arc of change. And I think that, and to talk about that in terms of how it changed you, in other words, it changed your focus, changed the way you looked at things. See if that's, is that working?
I don't know, is it? No.
Okay.
Yeah, well, one of the things, probably in the, I guess I went through, like all other revolutionaries during the 70s, I went through a combat stage, you know.
That.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't taking a whole lot of stuff, and I didn't want people bothering me, mainly the guard force. I didn't go through the combat stage with, like, the other prisoners. But there was that period in which I spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, a lot of time on lockup, because I just really didn't have any tolerance to be abused. And I didn't know how to keep my mouth closed also. So that created problems sometime. But somewhere in like 1977, when I finally kind of like decided that, well, okay, this is not really working for me. And I'm not being very successful in terms of organizing because all my friends are on lockup and I'm on lockup. You know, and so we decided to start working in organizing in a different manner. And one of the things is I started working with what they call today the self-help organizations. And I started working with one particular organization, Seven Step. We created a youth counseling program because we realized that there was a lot of young people coming into the prison system, and they was coming in the prison system, and they didn't have a clue before they got there. And when they got there, they was in future shock, and it was too late, and they was hoping that somebody had reached them before then. So we created this program for young people before they came in the prison system. And we worked with this counseling program, and we worked with young people, and we kind of like let them see what it was in the prison system and let them understand what their future would look like if they didn't make choices that would work for their benefit. And so for all through the 70s and the 80s, pretty much, I was like a counselor, a senior counselor. I worked with a lot of people, and I think I helped a lot of people. But somewhere attitudes changed among young people that were coming in. And this was around that period where they had the Scared Straight programs and programs where they would bring you in and terrify you and lock you in the cell and take your tennis and stuff like that, which wasn't for us. It wasn't very effective, because if you bring a young man in the prison system from Baltimore and you took his tennis, him and his buddies are going to fight you right there in the program. You know, so it didn't work for us. So the counseling program was a good program that we had, but the attitudes start changing. I started encountering people that were beating up their grandmothers. That, I mean, this is all this is directly in relationship to the crack cocaine, to the loss of jobs in the community, the massive unemployment. That whole thing impacted upon young people, and they came in and they were hustling, they were doing whatever was necessary to get money, to buy food, to live, to eat. And their attitude was like us against the world. And they didn't care about anybody or anything. And it really ran smack up into my values, because I couldn't understand. You beat your mother up? I could no longer sit there and counsel them, and they couldn't look in my face and see that I was genuinely concerned about them, because I wasn't. You know, I mean, I was like in conflict. So I had to kind of like back up from the counseling thing. And as I moved back from the counseling thing, I kind of redirected my energy to continuing to reform the jail and the jail structures. And ultimately, we got like 700 beds removed out of the jail, which I'm always kind of like proud of, because that was 700 people that didn't end up in there with me. But after a while, they start shipping us around. And so eventually, they shipped me up into Hagerstown. And I had the whole entire time I had spent in the penitentiary, or I had spent in the Jessup, Maryland region. When I went up in Hagerstown, I was shocked. I mean, really, literally shocked. I was in the new jail, in fact, that's where they shipped me. And I was on a plantation with 2,000 young men, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. And it just took me back to the 18th century tobacco farms. And it wasn't really a farm. It's technically just a jail. It had shops and factories and that kind of stuff. But that's the feeling you got when you walked out and you see long lines of black young men, and I'm talking for blocks, walking from their housing area to go eat. And on each side, there's guards with aviator glasses on. That's the glasses where they look like they're silver. You can't see their eyes. And they're standing there, and they have tear gas canisters that look like fire extinguishers. There's dogs there pulling at the leash as these guys are walking up and down to the mess hall and back to their housing area. And so I'm like, at this time, I'm like an old man, right? So I'm walking, but I notice everybody is walking up the pathway like this. Oh, I mean, you know, hundreds and hundreds of guys are just walking up the pathway looking at the ground. So I'm walking, and so I'm like a geese. I'm standing up above everybody else because I'm like, what the devil is going on? What's happening here? I couldn't understand it. So the guys are saying, don't look at the guards. Don't let the guards see you looking at them. So I'm saying, why? What's up? What's happening here? And the deal was that if the guards see you looking at them, they would call you out the line. And I didn't appreciate how devastating it was to the guys, because the line moved and it kept moving. And if you're walking with your two or three buddies, when you got into the mess hall and you got your tray, you sat down at that table, the next guy sat at the next table, and so on. Now, if they call you out the line and the line keep moving, well, your buddies are gone, and then they got you on the side, and they're taking your pockets out, and they're checking your shoes, and they're doing all kinds of stuff to you until your buddies are up there. It's, like, deliberate. So guys didn't want to be separated from their buddies, so they kept with the policy of not looking up. So I'm like, no, that's not going to work. We can't do that, you know. And so the guys that had came up there with me, and I think it was probably about 29 or 30 of us, we were all like, nope, not happening. And so they just got to call us out the line. So, but they recognized that we came from Jessup, from another area, and we wasn't trying to hear that, and we weren't children. So they never bothered us at all. They just never bothered us. And eventually, the young guys start, like, holding their heads up. And they start, and then so they stopped pulling them out of the line like that, because people realized that, well, damn, if everybody hold their head up, what are they going to do? Not feed you? You know, because you would be there all day long getting shook down, right? So that changed. But in the process, I'm sitting in at the tables and I'm listening, and I'm hearing all sorts of negative kind of stuff that's kind of frightening to me about what's going to happen when I go back to the community. What's going to happen when I see that guy that messed with my cousin? Or what's going to happen to the guys that took over my block? I'm hearing all of this stuff, and I'm saying, like, okay, this is not good, because I'm thinking, okay, my family's in the city. My family is growing up. My son is in the city. My people, my sisters, my nieces, my nephews, I'm saying, okay, this doesn't sound good. I need to talk to these guys before they go out. And they're going out every week. And so I'm like, okay, come here. Let me holler at you, shorty. And I'm talking to one guy, and I'm talking to another guy. And 10 guys go out. And I'm saying, well, okay. Next week I'm talking to 2 or 3 more guys. 10 more guys go out. So I'm saying, well, okay, this is not working. I need some help. So in fact, that's what made me decide that, well, okay, we need to find a way to reach more guys in a more effective way to try to turn this around. Obviously, we can't stop it, but we could do something with it. So I got in touch with the American Friends Service Committee, and I asked them if they would come and help train some guys to be mentors. And they came and they helped train about 20 guys. It took 6 months. And then it was those guys that eventually went out and start working with 30 or 40 young guys. And from there, we developed a program that allowed us to reach into all the different areas of the prison population and try to turn around some of those things. Now, of course, you know, no one program is 100% successful, and we can't reach everybody, but we started reaching people, and we started doing that because we realized that, well, okay, if people go home and if they don't have any sense of how to survive in the conditions that exist today, then they're going to be right back. But as they come back, they're going to leave a body, or they're going to leave something else. And so we need to do something about that. And so it was that that made me actually decide to change from the prison reform to working with young people again, and this time kind of like working with them in a more effective manner. And I had to get rid of my biases, my politics, my paradigm, and I had to accept guys wherever they were. And I had to accept whatever they were advocating, and then I had to try to work with them to make them understand that they could be still positive entities in the community wearing whatever hat they wore. And that means I had to take myself out of the equation and figure out how I can encourage them to move forward.
I'm really curious about a couple of things before we bring Green Bray up here and talk about where these programs are going. This society we're in now vilifies young black men. It makes them out to be monsters, killers, people to be feared. And part of the stories you told about people, young people living in utter isolation and dislocation from the rest of society, and the violence gets turned inward and people begin to eat themselves alive. Because it was different. You were coming up. A lot of guys were coming up. It was the end of segregation. There was a movement going on. People felt there was change in the air and hope, and that things were a little different. And then folks got completely left behind for 40 years, for 30 years. Communities just fell apart for all kinds of reasons, crack cocaine being one of them. So I'm curious, A, is how you think you get under that when it comes to working with young people in a community, and also through the lens of what you saw. What you saw in young people that others do not see. What was under all this bravado, under all the fear that pushes the violence. I'm curious, A, what you saw, and B, what does it say about what we need to do, what you're trying to do now that you're here?
I think the first thing that happened is when you take some time and you, first place, prisoners are isolated. That's probably the worst of all kinds of scenarios, is to have a bunch of guys that's isolated, that's being not necessarily abused, but marginalized and dehumanized. There's a level of rage. There's a level of just internal anger that's directed at the community at large, even though the culprit is that person in front of you that's slamming your door, or that person in front of you is telling you to move on. That internalized rage that's there, though, is about being abandoned. Nobody cares about me. Nobody took the time to kind of like give me a sense of what I need to be doing. Nobody was there for me. Yes, they brought some shoes, they brought this, they brought that, whatever. But there's a sense that I don't understand what I need to do to get out of this. I don't understand how to negotiate this. There is no time. And that's one of the reasons why, and Green Bay is going to come up here and talk in a minute, but it's one of the reasons why we're starting an outside group, because what we found out from inside was once you sit down and you start talking to young people and they understand that you care about them and they understand that there's some concern, and then further they can see outside people coming in and they can see somebody that's not their family or not coming to visit them, or not their sweetheart, then they understand that there are other people in the community that has a concern and an interest for them. That changes. That changes how they view the community. That changes how they view their self. When those changes happen, and this was like one of the positive and the negative things for me. When those changes happen, a light comes on in a young person's eyes, and you can see that they have made a decision that they want to move forward in a positive way and do something that will allow them to go forward into the future that will be beneficial to themselves and not detrimental to the community. That light, when it comes on, it's a wonderful thing to see. It takes a little work, but it happens. But the bad news is that if it happens in the prison system, that person is stuck for another 5 years or 10 years or sometimes 15 or 20 years. And even though that light comes on, it could burn out just because they're stuck. It's like, okay, I know I got it now. I can make something happen, but I can't get out of this situation. And that's painful. Seeing the light come on is great. Knowing that it might dim over the years is painful. And one of the things that myself and other people that have been working together, mentors, and there's a tremendous, and I need to say this because this is important, there's a tremendous amount of mentors in the prison system right now that's working today, every day, with young people throughout the whole prison system. They've developed skills, they've been trained, they've been working from just experience. Some of them were working before they got training. They're there, and they're doing that work, and they're turning those lights on, and they got the light on themselves, but they're stuck up in there. It's a resource that the community needs out here now, today. It's people that would enhance what's going on in the community instead of making the community more negative. We decided, some of us, that if and when we got out, we would try to do something to turn that light on out here before people got caught up in that system. And so it's toward that end now that we are working and building and developing an organizational structure right here in the city to start working with young people and to work in different communities to turn that light on before people get caught up and then can't get out.
I'm curious what the connection is between the work that you did early, even before you went in prison, the revolutionary work you did, organizing. I mean, people I remember back in the day would work with people who were dealing drugs in the corner, saying you're either coming in with us or you're against us and we're going to change what's happening in the community. So how much of what goes on with young people in terms of changing their lives is also a political struggle about changing the world they're in, about changing the community they live in, about changing the system that is doing the oppressing on the outside?
I guess it's important to kind of like bring this up, and it might deviate a little bit, but they had a really horrible program called COINTELPRO. You know, it existed for a number of years, and it destroyed and disrupted organized activities in all communities, in the Black community, in the white community, in the Native American community. And those programs were so insidious that they are still actually impacting the communities now. And one of the things that happens now is that the community is struggling just to trust each other. People are still fractured from the stuff that happened. And this COINTELPRO thing was a government program. It was an illegal program. It was an extrajudicial program, meaning that it shouldn't have been operating under any kind of circumstances. it really was a program that actually executed people too, or caused people to lose their lives, and locked people up, right? In addition to running people out of the country also. These programs damaged the community so much, along with the, and I mentioned this earlier, the loss of jobs in the community. The loss of jobs in the community, whether they went to Mexico or whether they went to India or whether they went to China or they went to cheap labor markets. It was about profits. It was about the owners of the means of production seeking the cheapest workforce that they could. That resulted in entire communities of blue-collar workers, whether they worked in auto factories or whether they worked in a Black and Decker or wherever they worked at. It caused them to lose their livelihood. It caused the community to lose the economic sustainability. It caused properties to collapse. And you have what you see now is a war zone. Back during the day that the Black Panther Party was organizing, we were organizing to empower the community. We were organizing to harness the resources in the community in such a way where we could take care of ourselves, where we could create our own institutions, where we could work across the board with other communities on an equal footing and have a positive relationship. And we created those kind of apparatuses and we created those kind of alliances, and it was to enhance everybody's life in America. And actually, we had a larger vision than that. We wanted to enhance everybody's life in the world. We're really ambitious. I don't know. I don't know what we were thinking about then, right? But we really wanted to change the world and make it a fair and equitable kind of world, economic democracy or whatever you want to call it. That was noble. Today, we don't have the community systems and structures in place to even do that. Right now, at least from my perspective, when I walk up and down, well, I walk, ride up and down the street, it looks like a war zone. The community is devastated. And I think that the first thing we need to do is start healing the community, because we can't even talk about building the community until we find a way to start healing the community. We can't even talk about doing anything that's empowering until we find a way to save young lives, men, women, children, and old lives. We need to find a way to do those kind of things and heal the community before we can even talk about any kind of revolutionary thing or any kind of progressive thing. What we need to do is find out how we can come back together and create a community. And we can't create a community without employment. We can't create a community without loving each other. We can't create a community without us setting aside all of those differences that COINTELPRO have created. And we have to start learning trust. And it's hard to trust when you don't know who's double-crossing you or who's doing stuff or who's working against your best interest. It's hard to do that. But I think one of the things that the Black Panthers advocated, that progressive people around the world continue to advocate, is like, you do your work. You do good work. You organize. Don't worry about Joe and Bill or Shirley or anybody else's stuff. You got to do your work. If you do your work, that's all you can do. And that's the way we can start developing a better community. And it's going to take everybody to do that work. And if you can do a little bit, do a little bit. If you can do a lot, do a lot. If you can do a lot more, do a lot more. It's that simple. And if you can only hook up with two or three people, work with them. If you can hook up with 100 people, work with them. The thing of it is find out what you can do, but do something.
Thank you. So, as you were just speaking, it dawned on me that in 44 years, when you left us, North Avenue, that we're on now, were full of houses with people inside those houses, walking the streets, and had families. And you come out, and you see North Avenue full of boarded-up homes, no people, no houses, and dislocation. That's... And you said it looked like you were walking a war zone. Of course it looks like a war zone. It's just a different place. So, Eddie, do me a favor. I'd like you to introduce Green Bay.
Okay, this brother is like one of the backbones of our organization. I met him a number of years ago when he was terrorizing the community. He don't like me to say this, but, you know, I mean, you walk through somewhere and you say his name and people will say, ah, you know. And we deliberately went out and we searched and we found people that fit that mode. We found people that other prisoners respected. We found people that other people would listen to. Because at the time, it was clear that, I was old. Guys would listen to me, and I didn't realize it at first, but they would kind of like treat me like a grandfather. Yeah, we're going to do all right. We're going to school. Don't worry about it. Yes, 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 yes. What you're saying is great, you know. And they would go about their business, and next thing I know, they're in trouble again. And I'm saying like, why did that guy tell me that? I believed him. And then I realized that they were used to telling older people that kind of stuff because that's what we expected to hear. So I said, well, okay, let's get some thugs and see if they lie to them. So over the years, some of those thugs had become excellent counselors, excellent organizers, excellent community activists, and now they're giving back to the community. They're feeding children in neighborhoods in Baltimore. They're talking to young people and saving lives. They actually help stop lives being lost in the prison system. And one of the very first ones that came on board and learned and growed and developed and has been helping and has been out in the community working ever since is Green Bay here. So I want y'all to listen to Green Bay and welcome him.
So welcome. Good to have you up here with us. And I was thinking about what you just said, Eddie, and we had a saying we started off on the air with about 10 years ago from Rose and Ashland on the east side, that there was nothing more powerful than the thuggers turned to peace. And what that can say for our community. So I want you, if you could, Green Bay, for the folks who are here, A, talk a bit about the work you and Eddie are planning to do together, and talk about your approach to it. You know, Eddie said it's hard to kind of lie to you, easier old men like us, and less hard to lie to men like you. But talk a bit about the work you're doing with Eddie, and talk a bit about your approach to it.
First, thanks for everybody for coming. It's a lot of work. It's numerous amount of work. But one of the things is this, things like this, you know, get an introduction to the people as to what it is that we do, going into the schools, the colleges, the group homes, the shelters, and things of that nature to give people a better understanding about their community, because a lot of people don't even know what's going on in their own community. They just simply just see the things that they see and just go on about their regular day. And in reference to what he said about lying to people, we prone to gravitate to the people that are just like us. So when you get a chance to get around the people that's just like you, you're prone to listen. And when you listen, you get a better understanding, because then you can say, okay, he been there and he done that, and he continue to excel from what it is that he's done. So they're more prone to listen to you. But giving back into the community, that's a priority in the way that we do things in the Friend of a Friend program, period. Because it feels as though when you're in those sessions for those months and you're getting to know one another and you start to make these promises to one another, not only in there, but on that telephone, and which is that's our world, then you become obligated when you come out here to reach the next step, the next people, the people that you hurt, you harmed, the people that you definitely disappointed, and you now change that from the prison to on the streets to continue from there. Meaning that for myself, going back into the projects, my image, of course, was at the bottom. And then when they seen me, they continued to talk to me as if I was still at that bottom level. And when I say the bottom level, it's them just talking about just straight grind me. You know, just don't even care about basically the next person's life, your life, or anybody else's. So when you start talking to them in a way that they're not used to you talking to them, they be like, man, what's up? Meaning like, you know, what the prison has broke you. This is the language we're going to talk about. It said the prison has broken you. You understand? And when you hear that, you be like, no, it's not, you know, this didn't break me. The idle time that I had, I utilized it. I utilized my time. And these are the things that I talk about to them, that, you know, man, look, what we was lied to, meaning to the older guys that was telling us about the game. We was lied to. We was bamboozled. We was hoodwinked. You understand? And I'm going to then show you the right way. And when we come back into my community, you know, we pass out the lunches. And not only do we pass out the lunches in the community, we talk to the people in the community. We talk to the mothers. We talk to the children. Even just to the day, earlier day, you know, I had to break up a fight on the basketball court. It was two little young guys, though. But at the end of the day, when I started to talk to them, I made some sense to them as the reason that they was about to fight. It was absolutely something dumb. You're going to get touched in basketball. You're going to get touched. You're going to get fouled in basketball. You're going to get touched, period, in contact sports. So now you're getting extra emotional about because you have been touched, and you touched somebody else also. And they're looking at me like, that didn't really make sense. We didn't even look at it that way. So this is what we do, period. We get people to look at things that they don't normally look at in a certain way. And we try to then get them to look at it in the proper way in which it was supposed to be looked at. That it don't necessarily have to end in straight violence. It can be an argument, of course. A debate about what it is that the next person has done. But you continue to get them that light for them to continue to move on so it don't end up, you know, tragic.
We've heard, and we've been on the show before, talking about what happened in your past, where you being railroaded by the government and being put in prison for 44 years, but now we're all out here. You're here. You're here on the outside. So what do we do now? What does Friends of a Friend do now in this community that takes the experiences of men like you too, and others who are in it, to change? What is it? I mean, people support Friend of a Friend. People want to hear what's going on. What is it you're actually going to do? You know, there are things in the city now like safe streets, people who are working on in certain neighborhoods to quell violence and work things out. We see the city has this curfew program that they just implemented. And so instead of saying, well, we're going to hire Green Bay to walk the streets between midnight and 4 in the morning, we're going to get the police to take little kids off the block and put them in some curfew center. You know what I'm saying? So I'm curious what the alternative is. What are you all offering to do in this community that's different than what's been done before?
You know, everybody had their way of doing things. And one of the things we go into, one of the group homes that we was going in, you know, we get a chance to sit down with the brothers that's actually breaking law, and their mind frame was just simply that when I get out of here, I'm going to continue to do the same thing, but I'm going to try to be a little bit more smarter about it. And I think that what makes our program more unique, because we do a lot of one-on-one, you know, and, you know, for each his own. You know, some people do the crowds, you know, and do it that way. But we prefer more so the one-on-one, the encounter with the people and the youth, that you can get a better, to me, I think that you get a better understanding when you're just on the one-on-one. And then it creates and carries on to the next people that's already out there. So we can get you in the stages that, okay, one-on-one, but also we're going to introduce you to these guys. These guys has a group that's way bigger than ours that you may want to attend to continue to reach the other people. And that's how I think that our program is just so effective. It's just one-on-one. We just in your here, in your face, and we just do what we need to do.
And let me add, one of the things that we did within the prison system was we deliberately selected people from a lot of different paradigms, a lot of different ideologies. I mean, we went in the community, the prison community, that is, and we found people that belonged to street organizations, whether they were Crips, whether they were Bloods, whether they were BGF. We found Muslims. We found Christians. We found black nationalists. We found college students. We found intellectuals. And I hate to say this, but we found Toms. It's the truth. We found people that represented people throughout the prison system, and we brought them together under that umbrella of friend of a friend. And we worked and we developed and we built bonds. And those bonds allowed us to resolve problems when one group had a member that was in conflict with another group member. We had key people in our group that could reach back and forth and communicate and resolve those difficulties and resolve those conflicts. And over a period of time, those bonds developed so well that people, they actually self-actualized. People in those groups were resolving the problems and the conflicts without even us going to them and asking them to resolve them. Something came up. Hey, come here, shorty. No, don't do that. That allowed us to create truce in some of the jails. Now, I've been out for like 77, 78 days now. When I left the prison, there was no violence down in the prison that I left. There might be some fist fights, there might be some conflict, there might be some beefs, but there wasn't. When I first went in that prison system, there was a body every week. Not always dead, sometimes 911, shock trauma, but there was every week an incident. And 5 years later, there was none because of the kind of organizing we were doing with the friends of a friend. We deliberately went out and found people. That's what we're going to do. That's what we are doing out in the community now. We're deliberately identifying people that can impact and influence what's going on, and we're pulling them together, and we're going to train them, and we're going to organize them, and then we're going to go out, and we're going to reach individuals like he's talking about. We go to colleges. We're going to reach professors, and we're going to bring in support. We go to high schools. We're actually going to high schools, counseling people. Once we develop this group to the point where it can actually work and expand, we're going to try to multiply it in the city. And we're not trying to change anybody's apparatuses, but we're trying to change mentalities. Whatever you're doing, you can do, but you don't have to be destructive to the community. You don't have to be detrimental to the community. We're not taking away your stuff. We're just asking you to figure a way to do some positive stuff, to do it differently. And that's what we're about, and that's where we're going, and we're developing that kind of apparatus. And even though it's only been a couple months, in a few more months, we'll be able to look at it as something that's working in this city, that at least is doing our little part We can't do everything, but we can do a little bit, and that's all we're trying to do.
Hi, you did a good job describing a prison system that was divisive and designed to keep people down. What would an ideal prison system look to you? If you had a magic wand, what would a real rehabilitative and progressive prison system look like? One that supported the community rather than tried to tear it apart.
Good question. Eddie.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I actually hadn't thought about that, but I know it wouldn't have any walls. It would have to be part of the community. It certainly wouldn't keep you and isolate you away from your family. I think the thing about whatever happens in the community, it's important to develop that family relationship if you want to actually reintegrate a person back into community and the community fabric. It certainly wouldn't stop you from having education. You know, education is a key. I mean, you know, to negotiating through life, you know. And so those are the things it wouldn't have. I don't know what it would have. I mean, because I would probably just not have prisons if I had a choice.
Anything on that, Green Bay? Okay, fine. Let me go over here. I'm holding the mic.
I'd like to know what's going on at the Supermax in Cumberland, Maryland. We never hear about it in the news, but it's there, and you've been there, right?
Eddie?
Well, the first place is a very, very, very horrible place. Cumberland, Maryland, I spent 26 days up there. And I guess in order for people to really appreciate the conditions up there, you would have to understand the Guard Force. The Guard Force is a West Virginia, Western Maryland National Guard unit that was in Iraq that did Abu Ghraib. Now, maybe a lot of people here don't know what Abu Ghraib was, but that was the case in which Muslim prisoners were abused, dogs were sicked on them, they were photographed in indecent kind of manners. There was a lot of torture and abuse for the prisoners. That National Guard unit came back to Maryland, and it is the Guard Force in Cumberland. Those are the same people. Those are not, I'm not making this up. These are the people that have been around the world torturing people, and now they're up in Cumberland, Maryland, torturing young men. And I mean torturing. The 26 days I was up there, I felt the most hatred that I ever felt in my life. And I probably have made some enemies in life, but this was a collective hate that oozed. And it's so stupid. One of the things that happened, I was in grad school when I got shipped up there. And just for a little background, I was doing my thesis on political prisoners in America and COINTELPRO. So I had a lot of books on the Black Panther Party, the history of the Black Panther Party, the history of COINTELPRO, the politics behind it, and so on. So they decided to ship me to Cumberland because I was working with young people. And sometimes as I was working on my research at a table, a young guy would come up and say, hey, I'm going up for parole next week. Tell me what I need to do. So I'd push my books on the side, and I would take a minute, and I would kind of like guide them through the steps of what they needed to do to have a successful parole interaction. The supervisors and the guards would come by and see me talking to people, see the books on the table, and made some assumptions that I was organizing a Black Panther Party or something. Anyway, they shipped me up to Cumberland. So I get to Cumberland. They take all my research material. So some of these books are actually about me. I'm on the cover of the books. It says, Eddie Conway, you can't have that book. I'm saying, I can't. I'm doing the research. I'm in school. I need the books. I need this stuff. We're not trying to hear it. You can't have this stuff. We're taking it. And they took all my material. And then at some point, the college professors and the community and everybody else leaned on them, and they decided that I could have the stuff back. So what do? They sent some guard to my cell and say, hey, if you want your stuff back, go down there and ask Lieutenant so-and-so and so. I think he'll give it back to you. And I said, and this cost me my master's degree, incidentally. And I said, nope, not going to do it. He didn't ask me, could he take them? I'm not going to ask him for them back. If he want me to have them back the same way he came and got them, he need to come and give them back. Well, I didn't get them back until it was time at some point, and this is something that I have to recognize the American Friends Service Committee put so much pressure on them, they finally came and begged me to ask people to stop. Like, we're going to give you your stuff back. We're going to send you back out here. We're going to get rid of you. But the point is that it was unnecessary aggravation for nothing. It was just hate. And it was dripping the whole time I was up there. And when I went out, I could feel a blanket almost lift off of me. But I mean, so it's a horrible place. And right now, it's on lockdown. And there's 2,000 young men up there right now not allowed to have visits. And they're suffering. And they're suffering in isolation because people don't even know how they're being treated.
Shorty.
My name's Shorty. I'm a prisoners' rights advocate here in the state of Maryland and the state of Illinois. I've done what Mr. Conway's been talking about. My question to Mr. Conway is a statement and a question. We traded the penitentiary for the plantation and cotton for cocaine, and black men in Baltimore are the cash crop. We are victims of the state's attorney and a corrupt system of judges that are making money off of our incarceration. The white gorilla family. We as citizens need to band together like Martin did in the 60s and start making our voices. Like, I'm from Chicago where the Black Panthers was at. We need to hold our elected officials accountable because, like you said, you got Toms going around here, and those Toms is selling us out. We need to hold our elected officials that have been in office for 10, 20, 30, 40 years accountable so they can stop this prison, cradle of prison pipeline that they've created. Your elected officials, our mayors, our senators, and even Governor O'Malley has created this. He's had these 69 judges. He has the state's attorneys where they will not prosecute other people of color for the same crimes that they're sending us to jail for. What is your opinion of that, sir?
We have to attack this problem on every level, and if that's the level you can work on and you want to work on it, like, you need to be doing that, and you need to encourage other people to do that with you. You know, each one of us. If right now, my thing is, I'm trying to save a life. But I understand that that might mean I need to be down in Annapolis, or I might need to be at City Hall, or I might need to be where on that basketball court. But because all of it is intertwined, you know, and we need to do it all, and it's something that I tell people all the time is that there is no one solution because there's 10,000 problems. And we have to have 10,000 solutions. And there is no one big organization or one big leader that's going to make a difference. It's us. It's us. That's who we got. That's what we got to work with. And that's what we got to do.
I am T. Larkin. I represent the wonderful nonprofit organization of African Heritage Walkathon with Sister Victory Swift, who has, we're doing some wonderful things in the community ourselves, and we want to follow. I'm sure that everyone in this room are here tonight because we want to know what we can do to help out with Friends of a Friend, with Brother Green Bay, Baba Eddie Conway, and with each of our organizations and everything that we do within our community service. With that being said, I don't want to put you on the spot, Baba, because I'm following your lead. But I won't do it. I just want to put it out there that we are holding, okay. Well, we will be holding our 12th annual walkathon, May 31st, the last Saturday of this month. We're going to be marching, riding, cycling, skateboarding, I don't care what it takes, collectively showing the empowerment of us together as humans and also for our children, starting from the Great Blacks and Wax Museum, going down to Coppin State University at Warwick Avenue. It's going to be an amazing event. I had a question for Eddie. Baba Eddie already understands, so we are in connection. I also want to state that we need each and every participant here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right.
But we need everyone to participate. It's going to be a wonderful event. Red Emmas, we're going to patronize. We want to represent ourselves together. That's the key. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. We'll go over here. Sir, are you waiting to ask a question? If you are, come out here. We need you to get out here. I can't walk all the way over there.
Good evening, Brother Eddie. I'd like to ask you briefly a question. There's so many young black youth, and a lot of people are being rounded up by mass incarceration. And there's a Stop the Mass Incarceration Network, which I support but don't organize for. I'd like you to speak briefly to the idea of the mass incarceration and how that affects the growing prison population.
Thank you, Eddie.
Well, the bottom line is this: mass incarceration is a direct result of no jobs, you know. And if you have no jobs, then people are going to have to engage in activities that's going to lead them to come in conflict with the criminal justice system. So it's a design flaw in the capitalist system. It's a structural flaw in the capitalist system. And until that's changed, you're going to have more and more people being locked up. Until automation and cybernation, that's like the robots and the computers, are used for the benefit of the community and not for Steve Jobs, he's dead, but for the individuals, yeah, you know, and until that wealth is shared, you're going to have millions of people being locked up. America and locks up more people than everybody in the world. In fact, it's like 25% of the prisoners in the world are here in America. And that's a flaw in the system. And it's got to be dealt with at some point. But right now, we just need to try to save some lives.
All right, let's go over this side of the room for a minute. Sir?
I'm very pleased to see you outside of incarceration. I remember when your mother passed and some of us wrote letters, forcefully saying they should let you out to attend a funeral, and they wouldn't let you out. So a number of us went to the funeral kind of standing in for you. So it's very good to see you out now. I want to ask you a question about one of the changes in the history of the Panther Party. I think it was around 1969, the Black Panther newspaper had a front cover picture of Huey Newton on the dollar bill, and the title article was Black Capitalism Reanalyzed. And it made the argument that black capitalists have a dual nature, that on the one hand, they're kept down because the bigger banks won't lend them money and they're not allowed to expand, but on the other hand, they exploit the community like any capitalist does. In my opinion, that was a mistake at that stage, and I think all capitalists are the enemy, and if we want to make humanity have a world that we, you know, that's right, we're going to have to get rid of capitalism. So I'm just wondering what your feeling is about that.
Well, I mean, it's probably, I mean, if you've been here tonight, you probably understand that we need to have a different economic arrangement. Obviously, capitalism is not working for us. You know, how we bring about that arrangement and what happens is something else. But we have to be talking, depending on where you're at, economic democracy, collectivism, socialism, internationalism, whatever you want to call it. We have to figure out how to use the resources of the planet for the people on the planet, or we're going to die. The planet's going to die. So, I mean, it's that's not even a debatable point.
Thank you, Eddie. Ma'am.
Hello. My name is Nikki, and I wanted to say congratulations on your recent release, and I'm very thankful that you are home and you made it. So many people have not. So there are a lot of brothers out here that are on the street. So me being a sister and me telling someone, a male, like, you know, that's not the way to go. What type of advice should, or like a speech, like some type of, just to change my speech pattern to tell them, like, look, this is not the way to go. You know, we don't want to condemn the community. You know, come do this. Come to this meeting. Come speak to these brothers that have been where you have been to show them, like, a new path. Like, they know it's a different path, but they're unsure of how to do it. That's not them. Or like you said, you was changed, or they turned you or something. Right. So, like, if you need to be turned, you need to be changed to show a different way. So what would I be able to tell these brothers on the street that are actually trying to just, like, get out of my face? They telling me, basically, get out.
All right. Green Bay, why don't you start?
They're going to tell you get out of their face because you might remind them of their mother. So, and I'm saying this because, you know, we know the mothers is there, you know, and we know what's going on with the men. We understand what's going on as them locking us up, and we understand that the system as the way it's designed to actually put us in position to go to prison. But my advice to you is to continue to say things and basically give them encouragement, don't give up. But you're not going to just change it over that particular speech that you've given, and you can't, you know. But you got to understand that there's nothing else right now in the community for them to do. They got to see a different light. You got to be able to say, okay, if I get you off the corner, but I got this job for you that can provide, you understand, the basic necessities that you need. You can't tell them to get off the streets and don't do this, and here it is, they're going home, and there's nothing in the refrigerator. You understand? There's nothing in the refrigerator. We know this. So it's going to be hard to say, okay, just stop this now, and then they still don't have no hope and no future there. They can't see it. Because at the end of the day, you sound like their mother, and we go home, and the mother going to say the same thing, and we still hungry. And I'm still wearing the same tennis shoes that Uncle Ray gave me, you understand, and passed on to me. So it's going to be hard. But I understand what you're saying, but you got to continue to press forward.
I have a two-part question. Eddie, I'd like to ask you, you mentioned earlier that after your release and seeing the communities that exist now that once had the capacity to sustain the organizing that was being done by the Black Panther Party is now in need of obviously things to reduce harm that's being done within the community, abolition being an obvious one, reparations I think also being completely apparent, but besides those things, what do you see as necessary steps to encourage healing within the community? I know that you've mentioned many of them already. I'd like to ask that. And I also wanted to ask Green Bay, you mentioned connecting with people who are being released and producing conversations that point to healing the harm that was done before people were incarcerated, having people reconnect and reengage with communities. Do you see a structure that could be implemented to bypass the criminal justice system altogether and prevent healing and heal within communities without it at all.
Start with Eddie. Go to Green Bay.
Well, you know, I mean, first and foremost, employment is the key. We have to start creating jobs. We have to figure out how to create jobs. One of the things that struck me was that there is tens of thousands of abandoned buildings in this city, owned by this city, that's not being renovated, that's not being used. And I'm passing bridges and overpasses, and people are sleeping under the bridges. People are homeless, and I'm thinking, well, okay, the funds available to the city is being used wrong. You can't have a healthy community if you don't have people employed. If you don't have a way in which people can take care of themselves. If you don't have a way in which people can sustain a healthy, normal existence, that's got to change, you know. But in addition to that changing, that employment, that whole piece there, you know, you have to talk about restorative justice. You have to talk about justice that allows the community to change whatever harm that's been done to the community, but at the same time, change it in such a way that will develop that person that has harmed the community. Which means that there's going to have to be people talking and communicating and trying to figure out what's the consequences of this action or that action, and how to heal, how to create peace in the community and development in the community beyond that particular act. That's got to happen. But and Che Guevara says this, and it's written on a wall somewhere in the office. And this is really it. You got to love your community. You got to start loving the people. It's important. If you can't bring love to the table, you can't heal the community, you can't mend the community, you can't work with people in the community. That's the key. So you got to start off with that foundation. Well, it's up here, really. But if you don't have that, then the rest of that stuff is not going to work. Restorative justice, economic, you know, justice, none of that stuff is going to work. So you got to have all of it. But there's so much more, and, you know. But Green Bay, you want to?
Yeah. To add on to what he's saying, to answer the question that you asked me, we got to get is the saying that the brother was using is restore the neighbor back to the hood. And I can remember, and I'm not even old at all, I can remember when the neighborhood cared. You couldn't just do anything in the community. You couldn't even really use profanity without somebody else's parents, mothers, like whoever, they're going to check you. And even in certain communities now, and they say just the homeowners, that they have certain type of structure inside of their community that you're just not going to damage it. And they understand what happens when you damage the community. There's no more respect in the community. And when there's no respect in the community, they can just simply do whatever they want in the communities. And that add on to, actually, the recidivism rate, capitalism, white supremacy, all those things. That's just part of the system and part of the plan. But just like you said, we got to get the people to start loving and caring about each other, that you can go and knock on somebody's door and say, okay, I need some sugar, without somebody looking at you like, man, the hell away from here. You understand? Compared to just, come on in, baby. Go ahead and sit down. Have a seat. Do you want to see something on TV? And I only just came for some sugar or some eggs. I'm watching cartoons now. You understand? That's the type of community that we once had. And we had it for years and years and years, even on top of the garbage that was going on. Once the jobs in which the brother just said, started to come out of the community and people not going back to work, people created attitudes. People gonna get depressed. People gonna start drinking. People gonna start using the drugs that was put into our community. We're gonna start doing all these things. But now we just gotta get it back to the point that you can trust the community again. You can trust your next door neighbor and can realize and recognize the actual real enemy.
Hi, Eddie. Hi, Green Bay. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Olka. I'm a part of the Baltimore Block Safety Collective, the anti-police brutality group here in the city. And one of the things that we hear consistently at the meetings that we attend with the city between the city council people, the mayor, police commissioner, et cetera, is that, and they say the right things, but they're doing the wrong things, that the community needs to take itself back, that the community can't pass on its biases about enforcers and the justice system to the younger people. And of course, we argue with that and say that some individuals aren't even enculturated into saying that the police are the bad guys, that they learn that later by an interaction or seeing something happen or hearing about something happen. But I wanted to ask you how, you know, we can, other strategies of organizing, you know, against police brutality, because the reality is that when you go to that area, that the result can very easily be death on the street by an officer, but they're protected. So, organizing strategies for that.
Eddie?
Well, I think you could take a page from history. One of the things that we did in the past, and we worked with a coalition, a United Front kind of coalition, we organized a community control of the police. And we tried, we tried to go down to City Hall and we tried to pass bills that would give subpoena power to community committees to oversee and investigate what was going on with the police department. Some of that kind of work is happening in other places, whether it's in New York or in other communities, and you probably need to look at it. But the idea is, in my head, is that you have to have laws passed with teeth that will give community a say-so on the results of what happens. You can't have those kind of apparatuses that's in place now. It's a review board. The people that are reviewing are the supervisors. The supervisors are not going to condemn their employees, and they're not going to penalize their brother-in-laws or cousins or partners. So you need to be looking at city council and looking at some kind of ordinance that has teeth in it that will give some say-so, because anything else is just chasing the paper.
Well, thank you. So we really do have to come to an end here. First of all, I want to thank Red Emmis for opening his door once again. And seeing this cross-section of Baltimore, black, white, Asian, Latino, young, old, gay, straight, coming in to this place tonight to celebrate Eddie Conway's being among us again. Thank you all for coming out. And before we all go, it's good to meet Green Bay. He's just beginning his work here with Eddie, and we'll talk more about that as well. Thank you all for coming out. Good night.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. And on our way out of here, we're celebrating Miles Davis's birthday today, once again, by listening to his sweet song, Spanish Key. Happy birthday, Miles.